Would you like to start, Mario, by telling us about your story and the story of the European Conservative?
My story? Okay. Well, my father met my mother. No, I won't go that far. Okay, let me be a little bit serious. As you can tell from the way I speak English, I was raised and educated in the United States. I was also born there. But I've never really considered myself an American or a resident or citizen of the United States, because my mother is from Bolivia, but she was born in Italy. And her family was exiled from Bolivia in the 50s. And so she was raised in Venezuela and Argentina. And my father is the son of Italian immigrants. But he learned Spanish as well as a teenager. And so that's the kind of milieu I was raised in, and speaking Spanish and Italian at home in the United States. I think it's important to say all that because it has a lot to do with my lifelong quest to understand my own identity and to understand this thing that today we call multiculturalism and to understand your belonging to a political community. Because in my case, you know, where do I turn to? The United States, Bolivia, or Italy, or something in between? I've never fully answered that question, but I'm mentioning all this because it drives much of what I do, that search for belonging to a political community or a civilizational thing. And that's the key. It's the civilizational thing that I discovered is the thing that most gives me my own identity. The civilization of the Judeo-Christian West is the way I like to put it, or what in the old days they called Christendom, which has been destroyed, fragmented. I think all that is a good way to kind of put me in context.
But I know you started the European Conservative, or rather took over the European Conservative, as it was originally a publication by the Vandenberg Society.
Yes. Should I say a few words about that?
Yeah.
Okay. A year after my arrival in Europe in 2006, I was invited to be part of a meeting, an organizational meeting, of a group of about 20, maybe 30 center-right, right-wing, conservative academics, philosophers, writer types, who wanted to start something in Europe. They didn't know what exactly, so hence the meeting. And we gathered in a little town in the Netherlands called Putten, at a place called Vandenberg Castle, more the Dutch-style castles. They're more like palazzos than big castles. And people like Roger Scruton and the late Caspar von Schrenck-Notzing, a famous German intellectual, and Milowit Kuninsky, who has now passed away, Richard Legutko, I believe, was there, and others. Remy Brog, I think, was also at that meeting, the French philosopher, and me and a couple of other random people. And we decided, well, we don't know what we want. Maybe it's a private club or a secret society, or maybe it's an educational foundation, or maybe some kind of think tank, but we're having so much fun together. Let's meet every year. And so every year since that first meeting in 2006, they've gathered somewhere in Europe. The preference is usually an abandoned monastery or some castle or something like that. And to be honest, I don't think we've ever really resolved the question of what we want to do, but it's been growing. Whatever it is we're doing, it's been growing. And this past year, there were about 175 people. We began with 20 or 30, and it's grown. I mention all that because in the bosom of this group, which has the formal name of the Center for European Renewal, but the annual meeting is called the Vandenberg Meeting, named after that castle or palazzo we met at that first meeting. In the bosom of that group, a young Swede, Jakob Söderbaum, had this idea that we all made fun of. He said, oh, guys, we should start a magazine or a newsletter. And I said, oh, it's so typical. The first thing you do is start a newsletter that no one reads. I said, go ahead, Jakob, you start it. And so he and a couple other volunteers started the European Conservative. It was a four-page thing published on a laser printer. 20 or 30 copies were made. And five editions of that came out. And it had an interview with one of the members, maybe a book review, and, you know, it was like three or four pieces. And after that fifth edition, I think 2010, if I'm not mistaken, it stopped appearing for 2 years. People got distracted, they got bored, they moved on to other projects. And I was at that time working, slaving away, and suffering really in working for a multilateral in Vienna. I looked around for something to do, and I volunteered for different think tanks. I volunteered as an editor. And at one point, I realized, well, no one's putting out the European Conservative. I'll just volunteer. No one objected. No one really cared, to be frank. And so I took it over. And I was like a child with a new toy. I said, well, what can I do to this four-page thing? Well, number one, I'm going to expand the number of pages. And I think I took it to, I think 60 pages was the big jump from 4 to 60. There might have been an intermediary stop in between there. And then I added other features, more book reviews, more images, and then I gave it a cover. That was a big thing. So little by little, Burkean change, I was changing it. And then I started recruiting volunteer writers, well-known like Anthony Daniels, and unknown, completely unknown, because one of the things I always wanted to do was promote the work in English of people who are writing in other languages, people who have never been published in English, young scholars, emerging leaders. And I think the big change was that this thing that I was now creating and building, I started sending out as a free PDF. And so I sent it to anybody I knew. I started looking through my list of people, and I just started sending out emails. Hey, I'm publishing this. You want to take a look? It's free. Mm. And people started following. And of course, you send it out as a PDF, then it gets sent to people around the world. And I knew something unexpected was happening because I started getting fan mail, emails, from people I didn't know in Brazil, a guy in Canada, and then there was one email from an Argentine who got it from a guy in Washington, who got it from a guy in London, who got it, you know, he goes back and forth. And that's when I said, wow, this is achieving something. Mm. Or at the very least, people are appreciating my efforts, because to put this together, I was using Adobe InDesign. I don't know how many of you have experience with this. I had none. And I was trying to teach myself how to use maybe 10% of its capacity. All I had to do was design, typeset the columns and insert images. But what it takes a professional typesetter maybe an hour to do, it would take me a month to do. I kept making mistakes. It was laborious, but boy, I was having so much fun. It was like being back at university working on a student newspaper. Anyway, that is how the European Conservative then became more well-known. And at some point, just before the pandemic, there were three incidents, and I'll stop talking after this. Not really incidents, but opportunities. First, at a meeting of conservatives in the United States, something called the Philadelphia Society, someone came up to me, the head of a foundation, and they said, are you the guy putting out the European Conservative? I go, yeah, why? Maybe, I think I said. And he goes, well, I love it. And I said, well, how did you get it? And he would tell me, oh, I got it from so-and-so, et cetera. But, Mario, I have money I can give you to, you know, if you want to print this, print more copies. How many are you printing? At the time, I was printing 200 copies, courtesy of a friend who worked in some organization that had a printer. And so this gentleman from the foundation said, here, submit a grant proposal and I'll give you the funding and you can publish the next year. You can publish 500 or 600 copies. So I did that. That was the first sign that actually people really cared about this to the point that they would support it. Then Daniel Hannan, who used to be the Secretary General of, they called it ACRE, right? The Alliance for Conservatives and Reformists in Europe, which is part ECR. He approached me and we had a series of meetings and he said, you know, I love what you're putting out there. Let me help you turn it into something more professional with broader distribution across Europe. Long story short, the negotiations went well, but in the end, he decided to launch his own version called The Conservative. I don't even know if it's still around. And much to my frustration, the first edition looked exactly like ours, with a blue border, and it was a quarterly at that time. I think the difference was that he wanted me to move to Brussels. I did not want to leave Vienna, so he went his own way. We never managed to work together. And then the third thing happened in 2019 when a foundation that happens to be based in Hungary, which is very receptive to a lot of the ideas that I'm publishing, approached me, and I submitted a proposal, and we got funding. And that allowed us to redesign, relaunch the whole thing, and that is the version that is now available on some newsstands in Europe and across the United States, thankfully.
Do you know the reason for the name? Is it a knockoff of the American Conservative?
I believe so, but I honestly don't recall. There were discussions about what kind of name to give it, and I think there might have been, in the early days, the idea that we could partner with them somehow and be the sister operation. That never transpired, obviously.
No. No, you have a far better publication.
Well, thank you. That has declined in quality, it seems.
Well, as we were talking, you got Roger in now, apparently.
Well, we scooped him up. Well, we take in all the refugees from the other conservative publications. We're a home for dissidents and intellectual refugees.
Oh, that's brilliant. I remember the conservative Dan Hannan's publication when it first came around, and I thought it was very good.
It looked very good, yeah, and had some good content.
It did.
Many of the same writers.
Yeah, certainly.
Well, I mean, I can say this now. I think the people he had tasked with working with me to produce something basically took the blueprint that I naively gave them about how to do it, and they ran with it without me. But that's okay.
But that, I suppose, tells us how your passion project has succeeded, because it has that force of personality, yourself and your wife, and now a great team that I've been so lucky to get to know a bit, rather than a sort of political creation. It really is something that you've really developed personally.
Can I jump in? Because you just said something very important here. Because I never think of this project, I don't refer to it as a journal or magazine anymore because it's got so many aspects to it. But I never refer to this project as a political project, even though many people try to reduce it to that. For me, it's so much more. What we're trying to do is, in part, reintegrate all these things that have been fragmented, the arts and philosophy and politics and literature. On the other hand, we're also trying to promote beautiful things, things that are worth cherishing and keeping and preserving, things that people treat with disrespect these days. So all those things are so much more important. So often during interviews or chats with people, they'll say, well, what do you think of the polls right now in Italy about Meloni? I said, I couldn't care less. Those numbers bore me. I'm not interested in those aspects of the policy battle and the political battle and elections. I know I should be at some level, but I'm not. Other people on my team are interested in that stuff. But my vision is very different. Because I think focusing on those things, focusing on those numbers, I think it impoverishes us. And my focus is much the focus of that magazine, Civilization, that I saw someone had over there. It's about the beautiful things, those things that really impassion us, right? And make one want to fight for something. You don't fight for statistics. You fight for beautiful things.
Well, many fight for statistics. It seems to me like a very narrow and uninteresting sort of life, but they are driven, very driven. But it seems to me that your approach is actually truly conservative. It's concerned with human flourishing, with truth, goodness, beauty.
Yes.
Everything the conservatives have been lacking And this is one of the main reasons I think conservatives have been so stigmatized as sort of Philistines, uncaring people, people who only care about money, for instance, who don't care about the environment, who don't care about culture, or anything of that sort.
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost like you read one of my speeches, or maybe I took things from something you said. But I've often said in public, if you're motivated to become part of the conservative movement or the conservative cause or whatever you want to call it, because you want to become rich and famous like Tucker Carlson or someone like that, then I don't really want to work with you. It makes me kind of take a step back. And incredibly, perhaps miraculously, the kind of people who are now working for us in Brussels and in Budapest are actually really nice, good, decent, kind people. And that's exactly the kind of people I want to attract. Selfless. And one of the things, and I'm not making this up, I assure you, one of the things I hear a lot from some of our writers and editors is, Mario, I would be doing this job for free. I love what we're doing. This is fantastic. I've never had a job like this. And I would do it for free. And I usually tell them, don't say that too often because I might have to take you up on that implicit offer.
You're based in Vienna, and may I ask why? Vienna in particular.
Well, Vienna is not only rather beautiful, but it's the crossroads of a lot of the kind of movements or groups that we're interested in. So, for example, there are several classical liberal, libertarian, Austrian tradition kind of think tanks and foundations. Mm. There are a lot of Catholic organizations and groups. There are monarchists and reactionaries. There are near Vienna, there are several conservative publishing houses. So, and it's 2 hours from Budapest and basically a hop, skip, and a jump to many important areas for us. So Vienna seemed to be an ideal location for us to be used as a base. Mm. And in fact, we started an organization there that that basically does some research for other people. Then we, when time came to give the European Conservative a formal legal structure, we looked around at several countries, including Belgium and Switzerland and Italy, but in the end chose Hungary because, number one, it was much easier to set up a nonprofit there. Number two, it seemed a more hospitable environment for obvious reasons. And number three, we have a lot of friends who have moved to Hungary now. And so we continue to use Vienna as our base. Our business or administrative office is in Budapest. And we also now have a news agency or news office in Brussels. We started that about a year ago with two people. And now we have five writers and three editors. So that's the growth pretty fast.
Mm.
That's why I don't sleep anymore.
I know it's been said by a few that Europeans can't do anything properly and you need Americans to come over here to run the European Conservative Revival. Is there something in that? Like the American Conservative movement is very professional and they're quite energetic.
Right. I think a few years ago, I might have agreed with some of that. The way I used to phrase things was not necessarily that you need Americans, but that you need either Europeans who have worked for multinational or American or Anglo-American enterprises and corporations, or who have studied in the U.S., Canada, or Oxbridge, or something in between. Because the habits of mind, the discipline, the work habits, etc., seem to be more common in that kind of cultural milieu than in, say, Italy. Mm. I no longer agree with that, because in the past 5-6 years, getting to know and working with groups across the center right in Spain, in France, and Italy, I've seen incredible levels of professionalism and discipline. And so now, if someone says that, I would consider it offensive. I think the capacity exists here. Why have we not seen it before? Why did I not detect it before? I'm not sure. Maybe it takes some time away from your home country to be able to see things in a new light. But I can point to specific examples. I'll give you one. The right in Spain is incredibly tightly organized and professional. Working with them is a pleasure. Their organizational skills, their attention to detail, is leaves a lot of other countries to shame.
Okay, but coming from America, of course, you've seen. I seem to remember you told me once about your Reaganite beginnings.
Yes,
and in Europe we have taken up a lot of the Anglo-Saxon political inheritance for some reason. I don't know exactly why, but Anglo-Saxon classical liberalism and Reaganism is really, it's been prevalent in Europe for some time. Do you see any change in this at all?
Unfortunately not. I think a lot of the center-right parties are still stuck in that kind of Reagan-era thinking. Look, I'm very sympathetic to that. And as you pointed out, I come from that tradition of Reagan and Thatcher and, well, Burke earlier, of course. But I actually think that we're facing so many crises right now that no longer responds adequately to what we need. It makes me think of, let me go back to 2016, before Trump got elected. A lot of us on the American right were opposed. We weren't going to vote for him. We didn't know what we were going to do until this anonymously written memo started circulating among some friends. And it had the title of something like Notes Towards a Definition of Trumpism. It was 9 pages, and I remember vividly sitting in the living room. My wife was knitting or reading, and I was reading this memo. And after every page, I think, I must have exclaimed, "Oh, my God." and she heard me say it like 9 times, 9 pages. And she said, "What in the world are you reading?" And I said, "You've got to read this. And it's clear that we have to vote for Trump. It's absolutely clear." 9 pages convinced me. So what did these mysterious 9 pages say? Well, it was this beautifully written, tightly argued document that inveighed or attacked the establishment on the right in America and said, rightly, and completely justified, and said that after decades of millions of dollars going to Heritage Foundation and CSIS and all the other groups that form the constellation of the American right, what had we achieved? Nothing. We failed to preserve marriage, traditional marriage. We failed to preserve or to cut taxes. We failed in every area that the right was saying was important to us. How is that possible? And yet Heritage Foundation got bigger and bigger in brand new building. And the people who led some of these organizations got bigger and bigger horizontally, right? I mean, like, what's going on? Well, it's an industry. And so this 9-page memo was this attack on the establishment, and it made so much sense. And what it concluded was that we needed a nationalist populist revolution. And it convinced me. Mm. And I'm bringing this up because that is what I think many or most or all countries need. Because it responds to the frustrations that so many people are feeling. And it's going to invigorate, I hope, the political realm. I think so many countries, are mired in just business as usual. I think of the Tories, and it's hard for me to talk about the Tories without looking disgusted, because, no, really, what have they achieved? It's all summed up in the change of their logo. We published this a few editions ago. I don't know if you saw it, but we reproduced some of the Tory Party logos over the last, 75 years. And it starts off beautifully. It's this woman in armor with a shield, with a cross of St. George, I think, right?
Yeah.
And then they remove the woman in the armor and just leave the shield. Then the shield gets watered down, and somewhere it becomes a tree. I don't know how that happens. And then the tree becomes a scribble, this blue squiggly line that sort of looks like a tree. And I think that sums up for me what happened to that party. But it's the story of so many other parties, I think, in Europe.
Yeah.
They're mired in the past, and they're unable to or unwilling to think new thoughts, to think disruptive thoughts, which is what we need to break open this fossilized thing in which we all live. And I'm talking about media and politics. It's all fossilized and stuck in something from the past.
Hmm.
Sorry, I start sputtering and then frothing at the mouth when I talk about this, because it frustrates me when I remind myself of the kind of situation we're all in.
Yeah, I think that resonates with a lot of people in Fox.
Good.
Certainly, that's one of the principal causes of our organization, is that thinking new ideas about what's going on the right in particular, but for our societies in general, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember reading the first European Conservative I read, an op-ed by Sebastian Morello about...
Who'll be with us this weekend.
He will. Brilliant chap. And about how all Europeans long for Pope and Emperor. Now... basic information about Norway. rather, we don't long for Pope or Emperor.
It'll never fly here. Right?
No, it will never fly here. So in Europe, there are so many different traditions. Here we are, at least I am, proud Protestant and a fan of the nation state. Kingdom of Norway, very good thing. so I suppose king and archbishop is what I'm longing for. but do you notice, or do you explore these different traditions and different regions of Europe in the magazine?
We do, again, thanks for bringing this up, because sometimes people make the mistake of thinking we're a Catholic journal or publication. We're not. We happen to have a lot of Catholic writers, but certainly not all. And in fact, we're planning to publish something very interesting called Why Protestant Conservatism is Best or something from a German scholar. I think the kind of space we're trying to create, Habermasian term perhaps, I don't know, is one in which we can publish all sorts of conservative, right-wing voices, Catholic, Christian, Protestant, even Orthodox from Serbia. We've also published people from Israel and the Jewish tradition. What we have not published is our articles or essays, contributions from explicitly pagan types. Now, we have a lot of pagan conservatives in Europe. France seems to attract them for some reason. Long tradition. I know, the daughter of the church. But having said that, and perhaps that was gratuitous, I mean, there are some fascinating representatives or exponents of that pagan conservative tradition, like Alain de Benoist, or from Element magazine, and a prolific writer. We've commissioned him to do something for us next year. We're not averse to that, but in the end, we do prefer to pursue and promote a vision that recognizes the transcendent realm. Now, then that brings up the matter of the Muslim faith. And it's interesting. This is a debate we've had internally, because there are some people on the right who say, well, we need to form an alliance with the Muslim world to fight against the godless elites. I've heard that argument many times. Then there are others who say, well, we need to only collaborate with the modern or the modernized Muslims to fight against the fundamentalists, fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist Muslims. And then you have others, part of my extended circle of friends, who say, no, there can be no collaboration. Europe can only ever be Judeo-Christian. I think these are fascinating discussions to have.
All right. Just you should talk, if you can, a bit about all the brilliant initiatives that you've got going, the new things that you're starting, bringing on new brilliant writers, new brilliant people throughout Europe. And I know it's not only you who are sort of doing new things. So, yeah.
Without revealing our strategic plan? No, I'm happy to talk about all the things that we'd like to see happen. Why don't I talk in aspirational terms rather than concrete things?
Okay.
What I would like to see is many more magazines and publications and platforms and blogs and new videos and all sorts of content, audiovisual, from all sorts of content creators everywhere. I mean, why not? It's all possible. You don't need a lot of money. You don't need any money in some cases. We're already seeing the other thing that a year ago I was telling the troops, my team, that I would like to see. More events, conferences, workshops, gatherings, book discussions happening more and more. It's gotten to the point where we really need to coordinate calendars, because there's so much happening that there are overlaps of 3, 4, in one case, 5 events on the same week. This is amazing. Something is happening. I like to call it that, an effervescence of ideas and activities. What we're planning to do, so we have the Quarterly Journal, which is one product. The website used to mimic the Quarterly Journal. It's become a completely different product because it's publishing all the news that we're producing every day. We have a weekly newsletter that goes out via email that has some news and announcement for events. We're doing monthly events in Brussels, usually policy-focused, and we're also doing events around Europe, sometimes in partnership with people, like this weekend, and sometimes alone, our own kind of event. And those usually do not have a policy focus. They're more philosophical. They're more academic in profile. Other things I'd love to see, and this speaks to my own adolescent internal self, is swag, products, merch, as they say in America, right? it's funny to think about that, but people really want stuff. I mean, at every conference we go to, people say, oh, do you have T-shirts? Do you have stickers? Do you have a necktie? Do you have stuff? And so I started thinking about this, and there's so many other interesting things we could do. Puzzles. I have a Joan of Arc puzzle that I got from a French right-wing bookstore.
I think
bookstore.
It's the American in you.
You know, it's got to be the American, but you know, there's a need for it because people ask for it. So where there's a need, you try to provide supply. I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's so many interesting things. We went to a conference in France last year, organized by Institut Iliad, which is a very, very interesting group. And they had a whole room full of exhibitors, and you wouldn't believe the kind of things they had. You name it, they had it. Flags and cookies and chocolates and
wine bottles.
Wine bottles. I have a bottle of champagne with Reagan on it. If you're a collector, this is stuff you appreciate. I'd like to think so. I might be wrong.
It gives one a sense of fun, of course, but being part of a movement and all the stuff that's happening. I think now will end the conversation and the podcast. So
thank you.